Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in studio is Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer and formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was up until recently the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fine.
Thank you for inviting me in.
And let's start with Edward Snowden. I know that you were the lawyer for his father, and the father was trying to, in effect, save the son from himself, in the sense that he wanted to work out some kind of deal to protect his son from the fact that he's obviously something of an international pariah and effectively wanted by the United States government and living under the protection of Vladimir Putin, with whom he shared the stage the other day at a very staged event that Putin does every year, a phone-in show where the giddy announcer said, Vladimirovich, we have a surprise guest for you. And then it was Edward Snowden, and they had a very softball conversation.
I don't think there's anything surprise that happened under Vladimir Putin's watch. It's right. All scripted. I think, Ian, that it may be an overstatement to say that Edward Snowden is an international pariah. I think that he's achieved kudos in many countries, certainly Germany and the European Union. He's received nominations, even as the Nobel Prize winner. So I think the attitude is quite mixed.
It is. I didn't mean to suggest that he was a pariah in the sense he'd done something wrong. He's just that, you know, he's stateless in effect. You know, he's wanted by the U.S.
Yes, and I believe that's really because only China and Russia are able, with their economic and military power, to resist the United States leverage that would come over every other country based on military economic ties and even the ability to orchestrate overthrow of governments, as in Chile or as in Guatemala in Latin America, as in Iran in 1953. So, and it's a tough decision because obviously China and Russia are testaments to the kinds of surveillance that Ed Snowden deplores in his public statements.
So what happened with your attempts or the father's attempts to make some kind of a deal to get Snowden out of Russia or back to the United States?
Well, there weren't so much a deal. We did make overtures, Ian, to the Department of Justice to try to ensure that if there was any return, that the trial would be fair and not compromised by a frenzy of press statements by the department and other leaders in the Congress and the executive branch, who have already convicted him of treason, even though he's not charged with treason, without any trial whatsoever. And moreover, there was worry that he'd received the Bradley Manning or Chelsea Browning pretrial treatment that was rather gruesome, if not verging on torture, and in substance end up having a kangaroo court rather than a due process court. And those were ignored by the Department of Justice. The most that the Attorney General Eric Holder was willing to say, and this was to the Ministry of Justice in Russia, was that Mr. Snowden would not be tortured if he was returned, because we're a signatory to the torture convention. Not convincing anyway, because despite the signatory status of the torture convention, it seems quite clear our waterboarding of detainees connected or allegedly connected to terrorism violated our own criminal prohibitions on torture as well as the convention itself. So I think that the department probably does not want Ed Snowden to return. I think they believe it could embarrass the government. After all, after the disclosures, President Obama himself has narrowed the scope of the NSA surveillance program. We've got activity in Congress, and really all of this is attributable to Edward Snowden. If he didn't have his revelations, this program would still be secret. And it would be embarrassing, in my judgment, for the department actually to be forced to tell a jury, you're looking at a defendant who's protected your privacy more than we were.
So what's his fate then? I mean, I know that you were dealing with WikiLeaks, right? And
with Julian Assange, and then there was also Anatoly Kucherina, who was Edward's lawyer appointed by Vladimir Putin. I think Vladimir Putin will decide unilaterally what happens to Ed Snowden. The rule of law is a joke in Russia. And if it's convenient internationally for Mr. Putin to permit him to remain past the 1 year of asylum, it'll happen. If he wants to do a trade, it'll be a trade. In that sense, I believe Edward Snowden's situation there is precarious. I think that Vladimir Putin wouldn't have any reluctance at all if the United States is willing to do a deal over Crimea or Russian influence over eastern Ukraine. He'd swap him in a half of a second. There's no intellectual, philosophical sympathy between Mr. Putin and Mr. Snowden.
So this is in many ways, on a personal level, it must have been hard for the father then.
I think it was not just the father. I think the whole family was undergoing great stress and mortification what the United States officials were saying about Mr. Snowden. And there was very, very great difficulty in having any communication whatsoever. I still think that's something that still needs to sort itself out. It's clear, Ed Snowden has stated he'd like at some time to return, but I don't think right now the conditions would be satisfactory for what he wants to accomplish.
But I'd love to get an interview with him, and it doesn't seem like anybody that's ever going to challenge anything will ever get an interview with him. And he's pretty much, they allow, softball interviews, but I don't know that there's any. Has anybody really had any real access to him?
I don't know, and it probably wouldn't be publicized anyway, Ian. And I think, however, your judgment may be somewhat premature. He's only 30 years old. Time changes a lot of things.
Right.
Sometimes it doesn't change things. But I wouldn't rule out interviews in different circumstances at an appropriate occasion. It may well be Rand Paul is elected president in 2016. There's a different administration, and the environment changes, and the tenor of communications and candor could be different.
So let's talk about Rand Paul, and he seems to be, here he is, a junior senator, a freshman senator, getting more headlines than Ted Cruz, who's basically a headline-generating machine. So what's happening with this guy?
Well, you know
the father. I mean, Rand, I take it his name comes from Ayn Rand, right?
Your description of Senator Rand Paul is probably fits then Senator Barack Obama like a glove in 2008, first term senator running for president. I think that Rand Paul clearly is someone who's willing to take risks, unlike others, go into environments and audiences that you wouldn't expect, the NAACP, Berkeley, California. He doesn't shy from, I don't know what they call confrontation, but from the need to engage in conversation and to share ideas. So I think there's no doubt that he appeals to young audiences and crowds. I was speaking yesterday here at USC to the Young Americans for Liberty. There are over 160 there.
And that's a libertarian campus group, right?
That is correct. It's not just a single campus group. It's a nationwide collection of students, probably the fastest growing in all of the United States. An enormous amount of what I would call kinetic energy and eagerness to support a candidate that will roll back the surveillance state, the warfare state that encroaches on our liberty more and more every day.
So what's happening then on campuses? In the 60s and 70s, the activism was on the political left. How much do you detect? You were speaking at UCLA, USC, and Yale.
Yale, Harvard, Charlottesville. There's no doubt that there's a huge intensity that I don't see on the left, if you will, the people coming out and supporting Barack Obama. And I think in part it's because the young people are able to see the encroachments given the electronic exposure and fingerprints that they already provide every day, the encroachment on their lives and their personal privacy. And they do clearly, I think, recognize they're living in a post-Orwellian phase of the United States of America. And youth does have that kinetic energy. It reminds me of some words by William Wordsworth about the American and French Revolution. Bliss it was to be alive at that dawn and to be young, very heaven. And these youths need sort of guidance. They don't know exactly how the political process works, but they certainly have the energy and the instinct, I think, that are sympathetic to Rand Paul's objectives.
Well, there's obviously some confluence, though, between libertarian philosophy and the left, although the Democratic Party is pretty centrist. There really isn't a left-wing party, perhaps, you know, Peace and Freedom and the Greens, but they are barely 1% or 2% of the electorate. So the confluence is, of course, there's an agreement over freedom to smoke marijuana, there's an agreement over objection to foreign wars, and there's an agreement over the surveillance state. But there is also a divergence, is there not?
I think there clearly is a divergence. If you want to talk about the government dependency or the welfare state, if you will, Obamacare and government programs that seek to develop industrial policies and put money into what I think many would believe to be subsidizing endeavors that people ought to undertake with their own skill, foresight, and industry, there's clearly a diversion on the debt, the size of the federal government, the size of the federal regulatory state. But I think those are less important, if you will, Ian, than the fundamental issues of liberty and the rule of law that are at stake with regard to the surveillance state and the warfare state. Most people don't recognize and would be horrified if they reflected every day that at present, as we speak, the President of the United States claims authority to kill any American citizen on his say-so alone if he decrees they're an imminent danger to the United States. It's been done on 4 occasions. There may be a 5th in the crosshairs. But just think about that. That's vastly more power than ever was considered by King George III. His just general writs of assistance provoked the American Revolution, believing he could search our homes and businesses without probable cause. Now we have a president who basically claims and has exercised the most awesome power in the history of mankind, and American people and Congress are rather complacent with that. And that ought to spur people, I think, to political action to try to regain the rule of law and our protections of liberty under the Constitution that basically have been eroded over the last many years under Democrats and Republicans.
Right. But, you know, you have, you know, some very powerful libertarians. I think the Koch brothers are fairly libertarian, are they not?
Yes, they are.
And they give a lot of money. And my sense is that you're attributing an enormous amount of powers to the president and to this imperial presidency and this surveillance state, et cetera, all of which I think is true. But on the other side of the coin, in many ways, it feels that the president is powerless, that Wall Street is more powerful than Washington, and that one of his great promises, of course, was net neutrality, and that is about to go out the window because of the power of Comcast and Time Warner and these powerful lobbies that are getting their way. So I don't think in this country, it seems like the industrialists have as much, if not more, power than the president.
Well, I think that's an overstatement. The greatest power you have is to extinguish somebody else's life and choose between predator drones and moneyed interests. The predator drones will prevail. But I want to make a larger observation. These interests prevail simply because there's a lack of courage. There's just not because the president doesn't have the power. He clearly does have the power. The authority of the government to prevent the mergers is there. The authority of the government to impose net neutrality, if you will, is there. It's simply that President Obama, I think, like most of the Republicans, have been bought off and compromised by the moneyed interest. You can go back to Sam Adams, which really expressed the heart and soul of the United States. And he was preaching similar, if you will, to those who wanted money and trade privileges with Britain more than independence. And he said, if ye love wealth more than liberty, the tranquility of servitude more than the animating contest of freedom, go home from us in peace, and may posterity forget ye ever were our countrymen. And so I don't believe it means there's less actual authority in the office of the White House or in Congress. It's simply that they've lost the moral and philosophical spirit to stand up and say, no, we are not a country that bows to mammon. We believe in liberty, and no, you're not going to get what you're clamoring for. We want openness and fairness and competition, and you're not going to manipulate the organs of government to enrich yourself.
But surely, Bruce Vine, you detect it there, it's in the political zeitgeist now, the issues over inequality and growing inequality of wealth. It's going to be clearly a campaign issue. The number one bestseller now is Thomas Piketty's new book about, I think it's Capital in the 21st Century, that is about how the rich are getting richer and the middle class is floundering and the poor are getting poorer. And I mean, I just interviewed a scholar at Princeton the other day who's done a study that indicates, he doesn't use the word oligarchy, but the word oligarchy is out there. Mm. And that is what seems to me the big question in our politics at the moment, is the extent to which have we become an oligarchy or are we still a democracy? That seems to be the main question. And one of the things that he discovered in his research, which was pretty thorough going over several decades, is that the powerful special interests in this country, if they want a policy, they have a 50-50 chance of getting it enacted. Mm-hmm. The middle class have very little influence, and the poor have no influence over our politics. But if the wealthy elite, they don't refer to them as in the study as oligarchs, but I think he calls them the wealthy elite or whatever, they have a 50-50 chance of getting their policies through. And conversely, if they don't want something to happen, it's only got an 18% chance of succeeding. So in effect, the wealthy have veto power over our government. That is a portrait of our current issue. So which is the more important, economic fairness or?
Well, economic fairness, I think, won't matter if we don't have any liberty anymore. You know, we could have bread and circuses and be a little bit complacent, but we would destroy ourselves as free people. Cicero described freedom as participation in power, and that's what we've lost. All the power that's serious has migrated to the executive branch, which frequently bows, if you will, to moneyed interests, but not exclusively. It doesn't do that. But in my judgment, if we're looking at two concerns, one, the manipulation of government to enrich the rich, as opposed to the use of government to run an empire where it crushes liberty and freedom, and we have surveillance everywhere, no due process, and we kill people, even our own citizens, based on the president's say-so alone. We will crumble as an empire, and then all of the economic issues will be out of the equation because there will be no country to defend. And that's where, in my judgment, we're going to be in 30 years. We got an $18 trillion debt that's just not sustainable. And continuing to project ourselves everywhere under the sun, now we're going to go to war for Japan over 5 uninhabited islands in the East China Sea with China. I mean, this is just madness, you know. And we go everywhere else in the world where anybody who says they're a terrorist stands up and says they don't like the United States. Now, I don't want to at all downplay the issue of inequality. I think that's exactly what James Madison feared when he said, we do not people to profit off of speculating on public measures. And that's what's happened here. They've manipulated and changed government from an institution to seek justice and to seek equal opportunity to one that creates special privileges for the rich to become even richer. The bailout of the banks is a characteristic example of that. Right. And in some sense, it has the earmarks of the eve of the French Revolution. Ultimately, there was a storming of the Bastille, but surely the economic inequality at that time was equally acute.
Well, my sense, though, is that one of the reasons why government has these powers is that there's an enormous amount of alienation in this country against government. You know, you see the people on the right, the militia movements and stuff, they invent all kinds of evils of the government, and they want to arm themselves against this government. There's a face-off now going on down in Nevada over a rancher, who, by the way...
But he's not alienating. He's mooching off of government. He's exactly. A sponge. He wants to graze on government land and not pay for it.
I know, but your candidate, Rand Paul, supported him until...
The
only other racist around there that's worse is Donald Sterling, the owner of the Clippers, which is our shame here in Los Angeles. But the point I was wanting to make, Bruce, is that I sense even more on the left than the right, but on the far left and on the far right in this country, an enormous alienation, this belief that the government is this remote, malignant force that they have no control over. Then that leads to all kinds of weird conspiracy theories about what the government's up to. I don't see in this country, given that only about 50% of the people vote, a real sense that we, the people, own this damn government, and we should make this government work for us, not work for itself. Where is that spirit going to come from?
No, but part of that's what the task of leadership is, Ian. And we have, I say, an acephalous political culture now. There is no leadership. But that's the purpose of being a political leader, to arouse and awaken the American people. We, the people, are sovereign. And that's the highest office of the land. And you have a duty, not an option, a duty to participate in government, a duty to have your eyes and ears being alert to government abuses, a duty to participate in the dialogue so your ideas can enrich the debate. And that's, unfortunately, absent at present. Now, I don't think the democracy is quite as decrepit as you've described. I think one example, which was quite refreshing, was the public outcry against another war in Syria. If it wasn't for that public consensus, President Obama was ready to fire 800 cruise missiles into Syria, and we'd be engaged in another futile fuel's errand, right. Making us complicit in further moral evils and stupidities. And so it showed that the president and the Congress did wake up when the shouting was sufficiently loud. But we need to have that regularly and constant. And it has to be an unwritten rule of American life. That's what you buy into when you're an American citizen. And that's got to be preached around the dinner table, the breakfast table, the classroom, in social engagements and otherwise. That's what makes us Americans.
Well, Bruce Fine, I appreciate you joining us here today, and I thank you.
Thank you, Ian. Been delightful.
Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, the Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was up until recently the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.